Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to today's program. I'm Tracy McClure with you for the next half hour for a look at the day's top stories. A joint study project brings the Vatican and the World Council of Churches together to examine issues of conversion and produce a unified strategy to face the challenges. And tonight we'll be looking at one of those challenges, how Christians, through their missionary actions, can be perceived by people of other faiths. And the forgotten child in Romania. Tens of thousands of children languish in unspeakable conditions in state orphanages. How Scotland's cardinal is sounding the alarm. Well, don't forget you can listen to this program and lots of others anytime on the internet. Our address is www.vaticanradio.org/English. Again, that's www.vaticanradio.org/English. In the meantime, thanks for joining us. We as Christians seek dialogue with people of other faiths? And can we remain true to Christ's command to spread the good news without offending people from different religions? How do the activities of some zealous Christian missionary churches reflect on other Christian denominations? These were just some of the questions examined in a recent meeting outside Rome involving the Vatican's Office for Interreligious Dialogue and the World Council of Churches.
Since 1970s, there has been increasing collaboration because we have come to this conviction that better we are ecumenically in the world, the more effective is our dialogue with people of other religions. Our dialogue becomes more credible if we approach it ecumenically and not separately, as it were.
Monsignor Felix Machado is Undersecretary at the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue. He says the Vatican has come together with the WCC to examine the challenges posed by conversion issues. The two have launched a study aimed at determining a common course of action, and it's a part of a series of other joint projects.
The objective of these study projects is to kind of help our Christians in their pastoral daily life.
The Interreligious Dialogue Office of the WCC and its Vatican counterpart meet regularly to share the concerns of their members and clergy around the world.
In several parts of the world, and at this time it was particularly from India, there were controversies growing between Christians and Hindus on the issue of conversion.
Reverend Hans Uko is head of interreligious relations for the World Council of Churches. He explains one of the red flags raised that led to the joint study project on conversions.
Following initiatives of maybe more parachurch groups and maybe more evangelical groups from outside India being involved in a zealous mission or crusades or whatever you want to call it, that created tensions between local Christians and Hindus. And following this, we began to think about whether this issue of conversion would not be an issue that we needed to address, not only given the controversy in India, but as an issue that has both interreligious and intra-Christian dimensions.
Often people suspected the Christians of not really being frank and honest, but having some kind of an hidden agenda. They think that we are using interreligious dialogue only to convert people of other religions to Christianity.
Well, some of you might remember the controversy surrounding Christian efforts to provide aid to the victims of the 2004 tsunami in Southeast Asia. Some Christian missionaries were accused of coercing Muslims into converting to Christianity, and the alleged actions of a few individuals ended up throwing all Christians into a bad light.
There are always a very few who do some things, but then the whole group is blamed for what is done by a few individuals. I don't know the exact statistics of what really happened. But why do you speak of these stray cases, I ask them, which are to be condemned if that is true? You know, because I don't think our faith, I feel and I believe firmly, our faith is gift from God. And if it is gift from God, it cannot be forced on anyone. Because God himself, since it is his gift, does not force the faith on anybody. Why should we be doing that?
Constantly, we have had reports on this from various places in the world, and particularly after the tsunami. The initiative that we are now launching, I think, has, within the WCC constituency, gained a support, not least because there is also a tension within our among our Orthodox member churches of mission in the former Soviet Union by, let's call them, more zealous Protestant or evangelical groups doing mission among Orthodox. So it has those reverberations as well.
But also, look at all the help that the Christian churches extended to tsunami people. I think we were one of the first and one of the most trusted people in order to help other people, you know. Let us look at the president of the Pontifical Council Coronum, Archbishop Cordes, who was sent by Pope John Paul II and sent in order to bring concretely solace, comfort, solidarity, help to these people. But also I know of other Protestant, mainline Protestant churches that went all out of their way to help tsunami people. Now, a few, I don't know who authorized them, but a few people, individuals, might have done something. These few are taken and blown out of proportion and given the impression as though all Christians are only doing this. I think this is unfair, absolutely unfair.
But does this mean churches should not evangelize at all out of fear they'll be misunderstood?
We felt that on the one hand, we want to say very clearly to everybody that part of being Christian is also the mission to proclaim the gospel of Jesus to all people. Part of being Christian is also to be able to invite people, all people of whatever religion also, to become disciple of Jesus by accepting baptism and incorporation in the church. So we want to make this very clear that this is not a hidden agenda, but this is part of the integrity of the Catholic faith. On the other hand, we want to tell people that we are proposing and we have all the right to propose this gospel of Jesus Christ to every creature, that we are not forcing anybody, that we are not imposing this on anybody. So these are two things we want to make very clear, and so we thought of undertaking this joint project with the Dialogue Office of the World Council of Churches and the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue. We thought that the general theme of this study project would be interreligious reflection on conversion from controversy to a shared code of conduct. And we divided this project into three sub-themes, which we hope to treat in three single meetings, of which first we have already had. The first we had was on interreligious reflection on conversion. We wanted to assess the reality, kind of see where we are, whether all that is being said is corresponds to the reality.
The World Council of Churches and the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue invited a small number of their Protestant and Catholic Church members to the May Study Conference. Muslims, Jews, Buddhists, and Hindus were also asked to contribute, but was anyone surprised by what they learned?
It was kind of enlightening to see that the people we invited were kind of helpful. They were there to help us, and they knew our intention was frank and honest. They knew that we wanted to really listen, so they were very candid and frank. No, in the sense, we didn't learn much because we already have heard the allegations and accusations against us Christians particularly, which I think is not exactly founded on reality. People were talking a bit in the vague, saying and accusing that we force people to become Christians, at least to speak for the Catholic Church. I think it is not at all true. And in today's world, I would really be surprised, and I wonder if this is really corresponding to the truth. Let's take an example. People in the United States, you know, people accuse often Christians forcing other people to become Christians. And they say that there are evangelicals and there are Pentecostals who do this. I have big hesitations to accept these accusations because, not because I'm prejudiced, but in the United States of America, there are so many immigrants of other religions. And I know the religious liberty not only guaranteed by the United States of America, but the way our Christian churches help these immigrants in times of necessity, but also in other times, that if we really wanted to force people, I think we could start from there. But de facto, it is not at all corresponding to that reality. So I don't want to kind of, you know, take a kind of a priori prejudicial position. I want to listen to people of other religions, but I think this kind of reputation that we just force people is not simply true to the reality.
I think also, at least by some Pentecostal and evangelical Christians, there is also an interest to try to see what can we do to address this, that we are not causing a communalism or disrupt the social fiber between Christians and others. And so, although we are not having maybe all Christian churches, be it WCC churches and others outside the WCC constituency, there is an interest at least to address this issue.
How many, if any, of some of these evangelical churches are part of your organization?
This is difficult to say. I would say that basically the WCC membership is more among what is called mainstream Protestantism. So we do not have very many of more, let's say, Pentecostal churches. There are a few member churches. And maybe among those evangelical groups that have their bases mostly in the U.S. and maybe in the Southern Baptist family, also are not members of the WCC.
So what steps are being taken to increase the dialogue with evangelical and Pentecostal churches to create a more unified picture of Christianity, of what it means to be Christian?
Well, this enforces all the more our desire for ecumenism, how important it is to be ecumenically united in order that our message, our Christian message, becomes more credible in our world. I think it is not for nothing that the ecumenical movement was born in the mission countries. This has been always the felt need that in mission we need to be one body of Christ. We cannot be a divided body of Christ. More we are united, better our Christian and more effective our Christian proclamation would become. And so this is one way, I suppose, of promoting ecumenism.
We had some evangelical Christians participating in this conference, and our intention is now to, in all humility, invite as many Christian representatives as possible from, if I may call them, the three constituencies that we have: the Roman Catholic Church, the WCC member churches, and Christians coming from evangelical and Pentecostal groups. So now we are involved in seeking to build upon the relations that we established in this meeting, following the process that is now to begin, where we hope to engage Christians from evangelical and Pentecostal traditions.
Reverend Hans Uko there, head of the Interreligious Relations Office for the World Council of Churches. You also heard from Monsignor Felix Machado, Undersecretary of the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue. The joint study project on conversion is expected to conclude in the year 2009. When communism collapsed in Romania, the unspeakable conditions inside the country's state orphanages were revealed to the outside world for the first time. Television viewers were shocked by the pictures of half-starved, neglected, and highly traumatized children who were kept under lock and key in their dormitories. Most people would probably believe that those appalling conditions are now a thing of the past. But although some improvements have been made, the reality is that nearly two decades later, some 30,000 children and young people, many of them disabled, are still being kept in horrendous conditions inside state orphanages. Some improvements made over the last decade or so include rescuing some of the children from the state orphanages and placing them in smaller units where they can participate more in the life of the local community. Well, one person who has been following at close hand the plight of those forgotten children is Cardinal Keith O'Brien, the Archbishop of St. Andrews in Edinburgh, who recently returned from his third visit to Romania. He spoke to Susie Hodges about his impressions and how his archdiocese is helping to improve the lives of these children.
Tremendously improved for those young people who have been removed from the state orphanages or institutions and are in what one might describe as charity-funded orphanages or institutions funded from Scotland or Ireland, various other peoples of goodwill throughout the world, but also they have improved within these large institutions themselves, quite simply because Romania is hoping to become part of the European Union in a not-too-distant future.
Now, tell us something about these community aid projects that are run with the help of, with the financial help from your archdiocese, as you say, that have rescued scores of young people from the orphanages. How do they work exactly?
Well, basically, funding is provided to build these smaller units, taking about six, eight, 10 children with suitably qualified and trained carers, with a wonderful homely atmosphere in towns, in the local communities, and taking their full part in the local scene, as it were, as far as possible, going out for their own shopping with carers. It really is not just care in the community, but love in the community. And young people in our own country have blossomed in that way, and I see the same happening in Romania as well. Young people have tremendously blossomed.
Now, although these institutions that they came from were called orphanages, in fact, many of these children weren't orphans, were they? They were dumped by their parents because they were disabled or because they had too many children or they couldn't afford to keep them. Wasn't that right?
That's exactly right. It's one of the strange things about the Ceausescu regime, evil though it was, that Ceausescu himself and those who were working or governing with him at the time were opposed to abortion. And consequently, children, terribly disabled mentally and physically and so on, came to birth as we would want them to. But they were incarcerated almost from birth in these enormous institutes, taking some hundreds of children. And some are still in these institutions.
During your visit, you did go and see a state orphanage. Now, you said although conditions had improved somewhat there, they were still horrendous. Can you say what it was that was still so bad about the conditions?
Yes, I would say what had apparently improved a lot was the standard of cleanliness. The bed covers and all that sort of thing were much cleaner than I'd remembered on my previous visits to that particular institution. But still, the numbers of children per room, the lack of really adequate toilet facilities and health care and so on, the almost complete lack of recreational facilities at all for these poor children. I think what some of these young people were craving for was just the touch of an adult hand, someone to hold them, someone to smile to them, rather than just being locked up in their rooms where they stayed day by day by day.
You said they were locked up in their rooms. Were they basically locked up all day? Were they ever taken out at all to play or move around?
Well, there were toilet facilities nearby, but there was no sort of playground such as we would expect. It's almost as if the children are caged in from morning till night. It's very, very upsetting being in such a place and realizing that no matter what one does or what a charity does, there still seems to be an unending, in inverted commas, supply of such children refilling the institutions.
And how would you describe the morale of the children there? Were they very listless? Were they traumatized? What were they like?
Listless, traumatized, and delighted to see someone who was interested in them. Invariably, when we visited, we'd bring a bag of buns or cakes or something like that, and the children would almost grab them ravenously. I just don't know how much food they were given, but that was another thing which was awful to see. It was like feeding animals in a zoo. You know, the children just grabbing these cakes and buns and stuffing them into their mouths. Sad for them, and sad for the carers, who, because of their lack of training and expertise, they didn't really know how to show love and care for these sometimes deeply disabled, deeply traumatized children. I was recently speaking to our Scottish Parliament on Europe, and I said that countries already in the European Union have a responsibility to help countries like Romania improve their standards so that they will become acceptable members of the European Union. I think it's a moral obligation on countries already in the EU to help others who are in need. When the Romanian orphanages first came to our attention on television at the ending of the Ceausescu regime, I think there was just absolute horror. And I think there should be equal horror, if not more horror, that these institutions are still in existence and that the Romanian government seems to be helpless at this present time because of lack of funding, lack of expertise itself. And consequently, we've got to reach out our hand in Christian charity, Christian fellowship, to help in whatever way we possibly can now and in the future.
What age are these children? How young are some of them and how old are some of the others?
Well, I didn't see any babies. One might say from about 8, 9, 10 upwards. And of course, that presents another problem as the children do grow older, what's going to happen to them when they leave the orphanages? Where are they going to go? Are they just going to be out in the streets? And is their last state, as it were, going to be worse than their first? And consequently, that's why I had a very kind benefactor with me this last time, who had asked one of his executives to visit the orphanages and see what could be done. Since then, a simple tyre-changing depot has been established on ground, owned by our charity out there. Obviously, as you probably know, the roads are not as good in Romania as in many other countries in Europe. Cars are older and requiring more repairs. So, as you say, this is a simple effort at having a tyre-changing outlet with a very well-trained supervisor, but with boys who are 15, 16, 17, doing simple tasks with regard to that particular trade, and having a farm as well to get them out into the fresh air.
I gather that around 30,000 children and young people are still being housed in state orphanages in Romania. How many in recent years have been rescued from these institutions and put in smaller community projects like the one that is helped by your archdiocese?
Yes, I wouldn't like to say nationally because I just don't have the national figures, but I know in the area in which our diocese is working, there would be about half of the children who had previously been in state institutions now in our care in the community homes. Still a lot to be done, but I'm very, very grateful for all that has been done. And the added incentive now given to the Romanian authorities themselves, it's not just our problem in developed countries, it's the Romanian people's problem as well, the Romanian government's problem as well, to take appropriate action to ensure that this blight on their country is removed as soon as possible.
If your heart is in your dream, no request is too extreme. When you wish upon a star as dreamers do.
Scottish Cardinal Keith O'Brien, Archbishop of St. Andrews and Edinburgh. He was speaking there to my colleague, Susie Hodges. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. If you'd like to hear this and other programs on our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Again, thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.